screen and map out where.
Discretion is advised.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. It's 11 p.m. Eastern Time on Wednesday, April 28th, 2021. And thanks for joining us for the 108th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We'll be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. Alrighty, as always, thank you for that. And if you don't mind, please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
So that was kind of a deep cut. I don't know if anybody recognized that one because it's kind of a deep cut from a band that most people know, but they don't know they know. And the song they know, if they know anything by that band, has been redone by a lot of other people, including Jeff Healey and Blackfoot. And the song that Jeff Healey and Blackfoot typically do is Got a Line on You, which is done by the band Spirit. That particular song was called Nature's Way. And I thought that would be kind of an interesting intro, given that we're going to be discussing the role that nature versus nurture versus environment versus choice has on various psychological disorders this evening. So I thought that'd be kind of a cool intro and kind of a deep cut.
Very nice. Yes, I totally did not recognize that whatsoever. In fact, I was sitting here going, I wonder if this is a shameless plug song, but no, it turns out it was someone else's. So
yeah.
Thank you for that. And
yeah,
as
it's, it was ahead. Unfortunate that that band's career got cut short. The main figure in that band, Randy California, who wrote a lot of their stuff and was a guitar player, accidentally drowned trying to save his son from drowning in the ocean. It was pretty sad.
Oh, that's kind of ouchy. Okay. And on that somber note, as Dr. Mathis mentioned earlier in his comment, tonight's episode is entitled Nature, Nurture, and Choices, which we will discuss in a moment. So before we begin the topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
So tonight's trivia, historical documentary, is also going to be a deep cut. So many of you know the instrument, if you will, that this gentleman invented, but most of you don't know what it's called. And any of you who have seen any videos or were fortunate enough to see Led Zeppelin in concert, saw Jimmy Page playing one of these, but probably had no idea what it was. And the instrument is named after its originator. The instrument is a theremin, named after Leon Theremin. And that's that funny little box with the antenna that you see Jimmy Page waving his arms around during certain songs, making these weird, like, synthesizer noises. And that's the theremin. And it started out, it actually was first developed in 1919. by a Russian scientist, physicist called Leon Terman, and later Theremin, who started out basically studying electronics and did work with, you know, electricity and very much in the vein of Nikola Tesla. So started out in St. Petersburg. I think was born in the late 1800s, and excuse me, studied at university very young because he had a proclivity towards all things electric and circuitry and optics and that sort of thing, magnetic fields. So by age 17, when he was in his last year of high school, he had his own lab. He was doing experiments out of. And one of his buddies convinced him to go to dissertation events of Abram Iaffe, who was, I'm probably mispronouncing that guy's name, who was a physics person defending his doctoral dissertation, who and later befriended Leon Theremin as part of his studies. So he was very much taken by Iaffe's work of electronics and electrons and the photoelectric effect and magnetic fields. So really started studying his stuff. And in his last year, in Theremin's last year of school, also he was very aware of Nikola Tesla's work and had built a million-volt Tesla coil and noticed a glow coming out from it. And he was always fascinated with this sort of thing, but his work kind of got cut short with World War I when he got called in for service as he was about to, you know, go into the physics and astronomy department. And then got sidetracked by the Russian Civil War. So he had a lot of interruptions to his work. Once all that foolishness was over, Iaffe had... founded after the war, had founded the Physical Technical Institute, I think in Petrograd, and called Theremin up and said, hey, want to come join me? You can start working with me on the institute, and we're going to be doing all kinds of things like X-ray analysis of crystals and using hypnosis to improve measurement reading accuracy, and working with this guy, Ivan Pavlov, who all of us now know the... Yeah, which had to be kind of rough. Okay.
Oh,
I know, because his work. I know his work went to the dogs after that. Okay, so anyway, God, I know this is ridiculous. Yeah, but so am I. Yeah, so
had paused puns.
Yeah. So anyway, he had done. Yaffe basically got Thurman to start looking at applications of these different frequencies, and actually made the first motion detector as a quote-unquote radio watchman, and noticed that this thing generated a pitch tone. And when he moved his hand around, this thing made different pitch tones. So he built this, he demonstrated this thing and built the machine to Yaffe, who said, hey, we need to show this off to everybody. So eventually he figured out how to make tunes with this thing. And Thurman was a cello player also. So he had started doing classical pieces using the theremin, so, which wasn't called the theremin. It was called the thing at the time, eventually named the etherphone, later to be known as the theremin box, and just later in the United States as the theremin. So that's kind of, yeah. That's kind of how that evolved. And so he was playing with symphonies using this thing, and people were like, oh, you know, this is the coolest thing ever. And so, so yeah.
Oh,
so eventually he gets married to his first wife, Katia Konstantinova, and they lived together, and he went on to Germany to sell this radio watchman device and the theremin patents, and started playing with orchestras and doing all this kind of stuff. And eventually, after doing touring of Europe, which included, you know, Germany, Paris, London, all the major, you know, sites, he eventually came to the United States and played with the New York Philharmonic. I think that was late 20s. And eventually granted production rights to his invention. He patented the invention in the United States and granted production rights to RCA, set up a lab in New York, and made further adjustments to the instrument. And started producing theremins, and they were showed up at, you know, concerts at Carnegie Hall and all these kind of, you know, interesting venues that people didn't know what this fingerboard theremin, and he also made a fingerboard version of a theremin, which sort of looked like a cello because, you know, theremin was, after all, a cellist initially. But he worked with, you know, famous composers like Joseph Schlesinger, and showed it to all kinds of folks, including Albert Einstein, who, I don't know if many people know that, Einstein was an amateur violinist when he wasn't doing physics stuff. So they all got a chance to, see this kind of thing. And, you know, in the meantime, things got kind of funky with him and his wife. And eventually he ended up, the Soviet Union had for some reason, I don't know if they disapproved of the marriage, I don't know what happened, but the marriage fell apart. And because he was playing with all these classical and ballet companies, one of which at the time was the American Negro Ballet Company, he meets this young African-American ballerina, Lavinia Williams, and marries her. And you can imagine what that was like in the early to mid-1900s. And,
oh, boy. Okay.
Yeah. And all needless right. to say, that was not a very popular wedding, either in the United States or the Soviet Union, and they ordered him home. And...
ouch.
And by some accounts, he was quote unquote homesick and came home, but his wife at the time, Lavinia, said basically some Russian guy showed up and basically kidnapped him and took him home. And basically, when he got home, he was put in prison and sent to work.
Ow.
And sent to work in the gold mines. And there was all these wild rumors that he'd been executed, but he was actually sent after the gold mines were sent to work in the Gulag camp system, which was actually a lab in the Gulag camp system, so he could work with these well-known scientists and engineers. And then by 1956, he had been, quote unquote, rehabilitated. So he was, you know, allowed to leave. Meantime, started, you know, doing all sorts of, developing all sorts of things, including, you know, spy systems, eavesdropping systems, which, and all sorts of different microphone stuff. And I mean, he just, he was a really, really prolific inventor guy and did all sorts of things. Eventually made devices that were helped in World War II during the espionage stuff and during the Cold War. So, I mean, he really has had an impact that was far-reaching that most people don't even know who he was. So in addition to doing the theremin, he did all these other, you know, eavesdropping devices and radio frequency stuff and motion detectors and all kind of crazy stuff. He worked for a time where he also taught at the Moscow Conservatory of Music and built theremins and electronic cellos and all sorts of, you know, strange electronic type instruments. But eventually, you know, people decided that electricity was not the venue for music. It should be used for electrocution. And at that point, all of his instruments were taken out and he was dismissed and he was considered like, you know, persona non grata, and eventually ended up at Moscow State University as a professor of physics in the acoustics department. And he started developing inventions there and supervising grad students, and then started performing again, doing, you know, concert stuff. Eventually remarried for a third time, Marina Gushina, I think, who was an, you know, an approved marriage, and basically remained there, at, you know, in between doing, you know, plays and touring, did some touring, and did a demonstration at the Royal Conservatory of Music in The Hague, and, you know, came back to New York, and eventually died in Moscow in 1993, and I think he was like 97. So in the meantime, people like, you know, some of these rock musician folks had picked up on his work. And Robert Moog, of course, the person who started the Moog synthesizer, which was used by, you know, the switched on Bach record and countless number, you know, Keith Emerson and just a shoot ton of people have used his instrument. Moog is the one that made the theremin popular. He's the one that actually put it out in the United States and ended up, you know, marketing it. Wasn't really that that popular at the time, but has sort of now made a comeback in recent years and people are rediscovering it. And Moog just actually issued an anniversary edition, like super duper walnut cabinet, you know, kind of theremin, kind of dilly, and, you know, with a little stand, and it's, you know, very glitzy and cutesy. But people are still using it to record with. A lot of people mistakenly think that the theremin is the kind of the weird sound on the Beach Boys' Good Vibration, that woo, but that's not a theremin. But theremin was used in a lot of these space movies. Probably the most well-known movie that everybody would know, well, the people who are old school horror movies and space movies of the 50s and 60s would know, the original version of The Day the Earth Stood Still. That theremin was used in that. All those weird science fiction kind of weird space noises are all made with a theremin. So that is a theremin.
Wow.
So there you go. It's something most people don't know, and you know, because of all this COVID bullshit, I'm still waiting for my anniversary edition to show up that I'm putting in my studio. So I have one on the way. Yeah, but it's probably going to be a minute. It's already 6 months overdue, but you know, I'm not in any big hurry, but I just thought that'd be kind of a cool addition to have in the studio. So
definitely. Alrighty, yeah. Well, that was pretty cool. So thank you for that. I am familiar with theremin. I actually got to touch one once, but I've never played it. I didn't really quite understand how.
Well, they're interesting because you can wave your arms around and it notice it's a motion detector basically, and picks up the motion of your arms and head or whatever. But the trick is, you know, how close you get to it versus how far away, versus if you shake your hand to get a vibrato effect, versus do you approach it from the bottom or the top or the middle. And yeah, I mean, it's not like, oh, I'm just going to wave my hands and make great music. I mean, it, as my friend Seth would say, it's going to take a minute. it's like any other instrument. If you want to be good at it, you got to practice it, and you got to kind of get a feel for it and see what it's like. And, yeah. You know, and I'm certainly in no way, shape, or form a theremin player. I mean, I can muck around with them a little bit, but I've got a ways to go on that bad puppy. But, you know, I'm going to use it predominantly in the studio just for special effects and kind of weird stuff. And if I can do some cool, you know, symphonic-y kinds of things with it or add it to the back of some of my acoustic stuff, I mean, I will. It'll be just kind of a nice, kind of a interesting addition.
Cool. Awesome.
So there you go.
Yeah. So that's the fact, Jack. All right. Thank you very much. Pretty cool stuff. You can learn all kinds of fun science on here as well as psychology. So, all right. So we will take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the rest of the evening until around midnight. So feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. Okay. Tonight's topic is nature, nurture, and choices. Given that our last topic that we did on addiction and recidivism and all that, we were talking, amongst other issues, about addiction from a young age, and also this is coming out of several conversations that Dr. Mathis has recently had with a few of his clients who are not necessarily just addicts, but some are people diagnosed with various pathologies that may have an inherited component to them. In other words, they're genetic. We wanted to give an expanded take on an old classic trope, nature versus nurture, you know, when it comes to behavior. As we did on our last show, we are also breaking somewhat with our usual format that we've been doing, and we're going to discuss these matters in a more extemporaneous fashion. So tonight we will discuss very basic aspects of the nature versus nurture debate, and I'm basically going to be asking questions of Dr. Mathis and putting him on the spot a lot because he wanted to do this topic, and I'm sure he has a lot to say about it. We're going to look at that debate relevant to mental health issues specifically. Also, we want to talk about ways to determine just exactly, honestly, how much self-control and agency an individual, oneself or someone with whom one is interacting has. And then we want to talk about how to find and utilize help in choosing appropriate behavior in spite of your circumstances. And before we jump into this, I'm going to check with Dr. Mathis and see if there's anything you would like to say before we start.
No, I'm good. Thanks.
All righty. So as I mentioned, I don't really have this all scripted out, but basically the first thing I want to talk about, basic aspects of the nature versus nurture debate relevant to mental health issues. So let's break this down into chunks so that our listeners kind of have a basic understanding of each concept, and then we'll put it all together how it all fits. So first part of the debate, obviously, nature, meaning genetics, biology, inherited predisposition, it's in your DNA, the whole thing. So basically we're going to talk about what are you kind of born, either full-on born with or born with the propensity for. Do we want to talk about that in general first before we get to questions?
However you want to work it. I'm pretty flexible.
Okay. So let's go first to how do we test for inherited pathologies? Is there like kind of a one-size-fits-all procedure for this, or does it depend on what kinds of conditions people have. Like, there's different ways to test for biological components.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And to my knowledge, there is no laboratory test you can do to say, okay, you have this that runs in your family, you have this that runs in your family, there is a 37.53% chance your kid's going to have this. What usually happens is somebody shows up at an office like mine with certain complaints, whether it's substance abuse and dependency or focusing issues like ADHD, or they're starting to kind of, you know, have funky experiences, like somebody that might be, you know, having a psychotic break, like in schizophrenia or delusional disorder, or they could be having, you know, come in after, you know, having many years of suffered from depression and or anxiety. Or they could have a bipolar, you know, symptoms of a bipolar disorder or a cluster B personality disorder. And so the first thing you do, of course, is do a good intake interview and find out. Well, part of that intake interview is, you know, the question is, hey, do you know if any of this stuff runs in your family? Right? Because we know certain disorders have a genetic component. Just because, and I've said this many times before in previous shows, just because somebody has a genetic tendency or predisposition in their family doesn't mean, A, that they're going to get the disorder, and B, even if they have the genetic marker for the disorder, that the genetic marker is going to develop into the symptoms of a disorder, because a lot of that depends on the lifestyle you lead and or how many compensatory resources you have. So, you know, let's say that you come to the world with the genetic marker for substance use disorders, right? So let's say you find out the substance use disorders run on both sides of your family, which means you're much more likely. So if it runs on one side of your family, you're more likely than the general population. If it runs on both sides of your family, you're a lot more likely than the general population. So, you know, if you have those conditions, which I do, by the way, then it comes, you know, becomes a matter of what other disorders might you have that would lead you to use substances as escape avoidance tools, or as I like to jokingly refer to it, better living through chemistry, you know, right? And part of that depends on your resiliency factor and your awareness of how severe some of these things could be, and your self-awareness factor and your self-esteem, self-efficacy factor, and to some degree your environment, right? Because if you grow up, you know, to quote Steve Martin, I was born a poor black child. if you're born in a depressive environment, black, white, or otherwise, and you don't think there's any way out, and or your role models, oh, this is how you deal with stress, you drink, or this is how you deal with bad stuff, you know, you get drunk and get into fights and get arrested, or, you know, you shoot heroin, or you smoke pot and chill out, or whatever. And the more of those kinds of things you have, the more likely it is you're going to start using drugs and alcohol as an escape avoidance tool, which then makes you more likely to trigger the genetic expression that leads to you becoming an addict, right? And I've said this before, I think, on previous shows. The reason that I'm not an addict is because I chose not to use any of those things. And I was, you know, and I've said this before, very few people that I know of are more miserable and depressed than I was as a kid. I had chronic illness. I was in the hospital many years. I lived on antibiotics basically most of my life from age 2 to age 19 or 20. I was surrounded by musicians since age 10 when I started playing, and I play hard rock and heavy metal predominantly as a kid and classic, what's now called classic rock. And, you know, and so I was certainly exposed to all those things. I had very low self-esteem because of the medication I was on. I had gained a bunch of weight because my metabolism basically went away. And while I wasn't eating that horribly, and, I mean, I wasn't eating great, but no, you know, very few kids do. But I wasn't eating to the point where I should weigh 230 pounds. And I was eating one and two meals a day and still weighing 230 pounds. And it wasn't like I was, you know, eating Twinkies and ding-dongs all day. And nobody was more depressed and had less body, you know, positive body image than I had or anything else. And I completely ignored the fact that I had this incredibly high IQ and I was two classes ahead of everybody. And I was doing, you know, arts and crafts and oils and ceramics starting at age four. And I'm not kidding. That was how early I started doing art stuff. And, you know, all those things, I minimized my accomplishments because that's what people who are clinically depressed do. And I was clinically depressed. And then as I got into my adolescent years, I got pissed off about the fact that I was depressed. I can avoid it. So I converted the depression into anger, which felt a lot better. But I was still this miserable, fat, sick kid, you know. And I had plenty of opportunities. I just chose not to use drugs and alcohol. And so because of that, I never developed an addiction. So I made a choice not to do, for lack of a better term, self-defeating dumbass things that would take me down a road that I might not recover from, because I was really aware from an early age that addictions were on both sides of my family and saw the devastation that stuff happened to them. And, you know, I'm a good observational learner, even though I don't learn visually. I can learn from other people's errors. And I kind of look at this and I'm like, okay, so my father's side of the family, all a bunch of alcoholic cluster Bs. This is a bad idea. My mom's family are a bunch of anxiety disorder, depressed, sleep disordered, which I unfortunately did inherit. And, substance abuse addicts, physicians, prescription addicts, and heroin addicts to put their sleep disorder to bed, no pun intended, and then amphetamines to wake up. And I'm like, no, not doing that either. Thanks, I gave it to the office. And so at some level, despite how angry I was as a kid, or prior to that, how depressed I was as a kid, and how sick I was, and how self-loathing I was, I knew that all of this stuff would not have a good ending if I started down that road. And so I just grit my teeth and many nights cried myself to sleep and isolated myself at school and didn't have any friends because I perceived myself as not being worthy enough to hang out with kids. And so when kids would try to make overtures with me, I rebuffed them. I would, I'd make all these excuses, you know, about why I couldn't go out and hang out with them and why I couldn't be friends with them, why I didn't talk to them. And I would sit in the corner in the lunchroom and, you know, eat lunch away from everybody. And I isolated myself on purpose not to contaminate them with my presence. And a lot of the kids that I went to school with thought that I thought I was hot shit because I was the kid that was breaking the curve. I was the kid that had the university instructors coming in and teaching me all these classes in high school. And I was the kid that was on the dean's list and the president's list and who's who and all this kind of good crap. And everybody thought that I thought I was hot shit. And nothing could have been further from the truth, right? And it's interesting because I've seen some of my classmates 20 years after the fact. And, you know, in addition to going, oh, my God, you lost a shit ton of weight, you know, which I did, thankfully, through holistic methods, because I've been written off by the medical profession pretty much. And they commented on, oh, you're a much friendlier, nicer guy now. I guess you don't, you know, you're not stuck on yourself anymore. And I just start laughing when I hear that.
Oh.
Well, that's what they thought. Right?
Yeah, I get it.
And I do, too. And I said, and I just started laughing, and I said, well, actually, the reverse is true. And I was explaining to them what happened, and you could see this oh shit look of horror on their face. And
oh,
then they
when
were
the
like,
light bulb
oh.
goes off, yeah,
right,
oh.
right. And they were all like, oh my God, we're so sorry, we didn't. I'm like, guys, gals, you have nothing to apologize for. I'm the guy who isolated. I'm the guy who chose not to tell you why I was isolating. What are you going to think?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. You came to a fairly rational, logical conclusion given my accomplishments at school. You didn't know that I had no self-esteem in spite of the fact that I was this, you know, genius kid, whatever. And I was winning art awards also in school because I was, you know, they had all these decorating, they like Christmas door decorating, and I would win it every year. And so everybody really thought, you know, and I was this kid hot playing on the stage and, you know, playing guitar, and everybody just thought I was too good for them. And I'm like, no. And so it's real interesting to see people's perception of me down the road. And they're like, oh, we're so sorry. And I'm like, no, you guys have a zero to apologize for. If anybody's sorry, it's me for being a dumbass and not saying, hey, guys, I feel like shit. Thanks for inviting me, but I don't think I'm worthy to come to your party. And then you could have said, yep, you're right. Or, hey, come on, dude, get a clue, right? But I didn't want you to confirm what I already believed to be true, because I just knew, quote unquote, that's what you would say. So I isolated myself, which made me more depressed and more anxious. And so it's like, hello, McFly, how many fingers do we have up? But at the time, you don't see that kind of stuff.
No, so, especially not as a kid, because you're not prepared for that kind of analysis.
No, absolutely. But I did have enough smarts to know that, to quote Mr. Mackey on South Park, drugs are bad, okay? And so I didn't do them. But that doesn't mean I didn't suffer. And anxiety disorders run in my mom's family, and depression runs in my mom's family. But I will say that the depression I had was more due to the amount of medication I was on and my environmental circumstances, because since I've gotten well physically using the holistic stuff, my depression has completely gone. My depression went bye-bye. Now, I still have body image issues because I still see myself as a 230-pound fat ass, and I'm the first to tell you that. I don't look at myself in the mirror. I don't take my shirt off in public. I mean, I have serious body image issues. I clearly have body dysmorphic disorder. There's no two-ass ways about it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very self-conscious about my body, even though most people look at me and go, dude, you know, you need to eat more hamburgers and put 20 pounds on. I'm like, no, no,
run away.
No, no. You're kind of like an anorexic, you know. And people accuse me of that. I'm like, no, I'm not an anorexic. I'm just a dumbass. There's the difference. But I just don't have the depression anymore because it went away, because it was environmentally caused, if you will, and to some degree with all the medication I was on, which really changes your brain. But I chose not to be an addict because I saw what it did. And so there are some things you can absolutely choose. There are other things you can't. So ADHD, for example. So if ADHD runs in your family, because it is a genetic disorder, and if you have a first parent or both parents or an uncle, a first or second relative with it, there's an increased likelihood if you have it, particularly if you're a male, and that runs in my dad's side of the family. So I should have gotten ADHD based on the amount of males in my dad's family that have that, but for whatever reason, I sidestepped that. So I did not get that. Hmm. But if you have that, it just then depends on how much of it do you have. Right, because psych disorders like depression, schizophrenia, ADHD, whatever, these are not like, okay, you're pregnant or you're not. You know, you can't be a little pregnant, right? But you can have a very mild case of depression or a mild case of ADHD, you know, or whatever, and it's much more workaroundable. But if you come out of the chute and you have the ADHD gene in your brain, you're going to develop ADHD. It's just a matter of how much of it are you going to have. And then do you have – what compensatory mechanisms do you have to offset some of the traditional learning disorders that ADHD typically engenders, like auditory processing, memory issues, obviously focusing problems, but executive reasoning, executive functioning problems, that sort of thing, and auditory processing. Those are the two biggies, the auditory processing, executive function. That's what kills ADHD people, really, just really is bad. And 93% of the ADHD people have both. So then it just depends on how early do you catch it and how many resources does your family have financially to get you the right kind of help that you need to start rewiring your brain. And how aware are they? How informational laden are they? And that's all environmental, right? And to some degree, it's luck of the draw, because if you get, you know, as I jokingly referred to earlier, if you get born into a poor family, you're not going to have the resources to deal with that stuff. And, you know, financially speaking, and you may not have, if you're, you know, in the backwoods of Appalachia or, you know, born in, you know, in the ghetto or whatever, you may not even know what ADHD is. You may never heard of it. You may not know what the heck it is and how bad it is or whatever. I mean, so a lot of that is the environmental cultural aspect of that kind of thing, right? And a lot of folks don't really know a lot about a lot of the psych disorders we have in our society identified. I mean, people know what depression is, sort of. They know what ADHD is, kind of. They know what schizophrenia is, kind of. But there's some people that still think schizophrenia is split personality, and that's not split personality. That's dissociative identity disorder, which is what used to be called multiple personality disorder, which is not schizophrenia.
Right.
Right. So even within our society, some of these, if you will, commonplace awarenesses are fairly recent developments in the last 30, 40 years, and people still really underestimate how severe ADHD is. I can't tell you. I mean, I have, you know, as you know, 85% or so of my adult and kid caseload are ADHD because you don't outgrow it. And it's just amazing to me how people minimize that disorder because they don't understand it, because it's been trivialized in the media. And honestly, even in my training, in my doctoral training, you study it and you kind of get what's going on with it, but you don't really get it unless you're in the trenches and see it day in and day out and hear the lives of people who are, you know, sufferers of that. And it's a serious ass life disorder. And, you know, people just kind of think, oh, they're just going to fidgety. And I'm like, no. You know, or people go, oh, I know you've got clinical depression. Just snap out of it. Don't worry.
Oh.
Be happy.
Oh, God.
You know, and I'm like, okay. So you just got your arm cut off. Just snap out of it and generate another one.
Yeah, walk it off.
Yeah. I know you only got one leg. I know you're down to your last leg, but walk it off. Yeah, right. And, you know, and people got to look at me like, you know, screw you when I say that to them. But I'm like, no, you don't understand what a clinical depression is like. Let me tell you what it's like, you know. And here's what anxiety disorders are really like. You know, and when you get down to describing them and educating people about them, it's like, Oh, gee, I guess I've been too hard on my wife, or gee, I guess I've been too hard on my kid, or gee, I guess I just didn't really understand my husband or my boyfriend or whatever. And I'm like, yeah. Now, I'm not giving people a get out of jail free card who have that to use as an excuse for failure, because it's not. But it certainly does make existence more challenging, and there's no two ways about it. And the longer you let it go, the more your brain miswires. And the more your brain miswires, the more serious the disorder progresses, because most of these disorders are progressive. They don't usually go away. ADHD is a hugely progressive disorder. Schizophrenia is a progressive disorder. Bipolar is a progressive disorder. Depression
can't.
And
so to be clear for our lay people listeners, when you say it's a progressive disorder, just to make sure I'm understanding it correctly, that means you're not going to snap out of it. You're not going to diet it away or drug yourself into making it go away. It's always going to need to be managed. Is that basically what you mean?
So there are forms of depression and forms of anxiety that will go away with time, only if the anxiety and depression are predominantly environmentally engendered. So
okay.
You're in a high, okay. So let's say you just get hired for a high stress job. And right now your anxiety is through the roof because you're in a position, you've been hired in a position to try to save this company from bankruptcy.
Ooh,
and,
no pressure.
Yeah. And it all depends on your financial management skills and, you know, can you divest yourself of some holdings of the company and you're going to be stressed, right? If you have an illness that you get and you're sick for a while you know, more than 6 months or 2 years or whatever, the likelihood of you having depression and anxiety is increased because certain biochemical disorders, physiological disorders, have deleterious effects on your brain, which increases your likelihood of anxiety and depression. I don't know too many cancer patients who are happy children, right? Or AIDS patients,
yeah.
Right? Or multiple sclerosis patients, right? It's like you get those diagnoses, you automatically are not happy because your brain starts going, oh shit, now what am I going to do? Oh my God, am I going to die? How is this going to impact my nervous system? And right? And in some cases, you know, you need to be concerned. But if you don't get a handle on that, then it turns into full-blown depression or full-blown anxiety or both. And if you don't take care of it, it just continues to miswire your brain. Your brain gets worse and worse every year. If it's just a temporary, hey, you're going to have this job for 2 years trying to save this company. If you save the company, we're going to give you a promotion. If you're not, we're just going to put you back in your old position. And while you may be sad if you're not able to save the company because you have a conscience and you're concerned about other people losing their job and whatever, once it's over, the anxiety level goes down. You know, you've been healed, Christ Jesus, and your anxiety goes away, right? But let's say that you have anxiety that runs in your family. You have somebody with OCD, which is an anxiety disorder, right? And you have somebody who has generalized anxiety or social anxiety disorder, right? And now you develop an anxiety disorder based on work. That might trigger some genetic code in your body that you didn't even know was there. And now you can't go to the environmental stressor event is over and you still feel anxious. So how much of it becomes nature versus nurture really depends on your family tree, your resiliency, and the environment you're in. So all of these factors, you know, your personality structure, all of these factors play together. And your socioeconomic status, the culture you grew up in. That's another thing, your cultural heritage in general. So do you belong to a cultural group, ethnic, racial, national, whatever, that says, you know what, mental disorders really don't exist. Or if you have a mental disorder, you're a weak piece of BS and you can't admit it. Or mental disorders are family problems. We don't talk about family problems outside the family. So going for help is shameful.
Yeah.
Right. Obviously, if you have a depression, even if it's environmentally caused, right, or anxiety or whatever, and then you're not allowed to get help because you're shamed if you do, this is not going to help your situation. And this is not going away.
Do you mind if I actually jump in here and ask you a question about that part? I'm actually going to mush sections 2 and 3 together here. Earlier, you were talking about how you had just decided to not do drugs after what you saw. But one of the things that I kind of wanted to talk about tonight is that it's great that you did that, but there are a lot of people who, for whatever reason, either shitty choices or being picked on or being in a culture or whatever, a community where it's not okay. So whatever happens, all of a sudden they're 30. And this stream of crappy choices. So they've gotten here. They don't know how it works. They don't know what's serious. They don't feel like they can ask questions. What would you say to somebody like that who's really gotten off on a bad foot to try to turn this ship around and actually start being able to choose, you know, not just going, oh, my parents are alcoholics. I'll always be an alcoholic. I can't do anything. You know, what would you say to somebody to start arresting that process if they really don't know what they're doing?
Well, I hear that a lot from people who have chronic depression, believe it or not.
Okay.
They'll say, oh, well, chronic depression runs in my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been diagnosed with chronic depression. This is from a 40-something-year-old. And I've been on medication since I was in my 20s. Well, that's mistake number 5,643 already. Right, because medication doesn't fix anything. All it does is force your brain to produce certain chemicals. And unfortunately, the medication that this person is on is one of the medications that the drug companies, as you've heard me talk about, that the drug companies sent out flyers to all the physicians saying, if you've been on this class of medications with your patients for more than 2 years, get your patients off of them. And this person's been on this class of medications for 20 years.
Oh, God.
And
their
psychiatrist continues to give them this medication. And they truly believe that they are damned and that they don't have a choice and that if they go off the medication, they will die. Now, this person's histrionic as hell, too. And I'm actually working with this parent, with this person's spouse. And the person came in one time to see me, and I said, hey, why aren't you doing some of this? I'm not suggesting you do it with me, but let me give you a quick eval, and then I'll refer you to one of my colleagues, because that way you'll have your own therapist, and I won't be involved, and, you know, oh, no, you know, I'm beyond hope, blah, 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 and I'm like, oh, shit. And
yeah.
this person really believes that. And my comment to this person's spouse is, Your spouse is afraid. Your spouse is afraid that your spouse will go to somebody like me and get tested, and the person will say, I'm sorry, you're just screwed. I said, and of course, nobody's going to say that because your spouse has a lot of resources. Your spouse is not a helpless child. Your spouse has inherited a shoot ton of money. So finances aren't an issue, and your spouse can really do this, but your spouse has got to quit drinking, 15 alcoholic drinks a night and take the antidepressant medication. What's wrong with this picture?
And lying
to their psychiatrist that they're doing that. Oh, I'm just taking an occasional drink. Okay, then you're fine.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Drinking every night is not an occasional drink, right?
Yeah.
Right. And so this person simply refuses to do anything about it because this person really believes that they are helpless. And with those kind of people, you stand a very bad chance of convincing them otherwise. Now, if this person were to go in and let's say get an intake interview and do an MMPI, I'm sure this person would come out very depressed. This person would probably come out very cluster B-esque because this person has cluster B behaviors. But both of those are workaroundable if that person wants to get off their collective complacency and do something about it. They're not death sentences. They're not, okay, just go out and shoot yourself tomorrow because you're fucked and you're going to be fucked. Excuse my French. And I would never, in somebody in this person's situation, I would never say that to because they are helpable. I know that's not a word. But
yeah.
They
can be helped, yeah.
Yeah, they're capable of change. They're capable of improvement. But they just refuse to do it. And so I see that more, honestly, I see that more with PTSD people, which is, even though it's been taken out of the anxiety rubric, it's still an anxiety-type disorder. I see that more with chronic PTSD people and depression people than I do with addicts. But I do see it with the addicts, too, and you're absolutely right about that. Folks do come in and say, well, I've relapsed 14 or 15 times, which is not uncommon, and I've tried to get sober, and I'm just helpless. Just help my kid. Or, just work with my spouse or work with my cat or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm just there's no use for me to come see somebody like you because I've already tried this and I've tried that and it's not worked. Well, they haven't tried the right thing or they haven't tried it severely enough because anybody who wants to get better can get better. But it does take that hugely obscene, nasty four-letter word that nobody wants to say, which is work, as you well know. And it requires you to belly up to the bar of life, not the other one. And, and grab yourself by the yin-yang and get busy. And a lot of people are afraid. Fear is a big factor. They're scared. They don't have what it takes. They're scared. They're incompetent. They're scared. Fill in the blank. And that's what keeps them from claiming their power, frankly. I think I see very few people in my office. And you know I've been doing this for a really long time, and most of the folks I see are pretty severe cases. These aren't lightweights. I see very few people who aren't capable of major improvement. I can count on one hand the number of people I've seen over the years that I would say, yeah, you know what, you can get a little bit better, but you're probably not going to be the star of the track team. And those are the people who have chronic, you know, IQ issues in the intellectual disabilities range and or very severe autism spectrum folks. Now, they can make their life better, but those folks are not going to be normal. They're quote-unquote, they're not going to have a quote-unquote normal life. They can do some things that other folks can do, but those folks are never going to be fabulous. And I'm not going to lie to them or their caregivers or whatever, but I see so few of those people versus other folks who have very severe pathology who are workable, but they just refuse to do it because they're either lazy, no offense when I say that, or they're scared, and they're scared because they don't have the self-esteem or the self-efficacy. They don't believe in themselves to do it. And part of what I have to convince them, if they'll stick with me for a while, is that, yeah, you can. You can claim your power and do amazing things, but you can't shy away from it, and you got to approach it the right way. Let me give you the tools and give you the roadmap, because that's really what I do. I'm not, you know, any sort of, you know, I don't wave a magic wand. I don't put my Bullwinkle shirt on and go, eeny, meeny, chilly, meeny, the spirits are about to speak, you know, and send them to Watsamata U, you know, college, the Bullwinkle University. And, you know, I really just get them to claim their power. I get them to I show them the light. I show them the way and give them the tools. And sometimes I kick them in the butt, and sometimes I encourage them, and sometimes I hug them in a figurative way, obviously, and get them to do the work. And if they do the work, they get better. And then as they get better, they're like, oh, shit, hey, maybe I can do this. And then we're off to the races. But a lot of people drop out prematurely because it's hard work, and it's a lot of struggle in the first 6 months to a year, particularly people who have chronic problems with depression, anxiety, whatever. And it's, you know, and they've had, and some of these folks have tried and had histories of failure, but they've gone about it the wrong way because they didn't know any better, and they went to clinicians who frankly weren't capable of dealing with the level of severity these folks had, and they didn't do them any favors. And I don't say that to slam anybody. I'm saying reality. That's all. I don't mean to slam anybody.
Gotcha. Whew.
I find it sad, really.
Yeah. Okay, so we're getting close to the top of the hour, and I'm trying to think if there's anything else that I really want to ask about this. I guess in closing, is there anything else that you really want to mention for people that are struggling with this as far as, you know, I don't want to say that they can't be normal. I want to kind of shy away from that and just say, you know, neurotypical.
Yeah,
for now.
What I'm going to say is this, you know, you and I both know, and this is going to come as no surprise to anybody who's listened to this show, you know,
yeah.
I'm about as far from normal as you can get. Right.
Also true, but I'm going to let you say that about yourself.
Well, no, I have no problem saying that.
Oh,
and
I
have a, you know, and I have a great life. I love my life. And I've certainly had my struggles, and I continue to have my struggles, but I don't shy away from the work. And I continue to grow, and I continue to take, you know, claim my awesomeness, and I don't say that in a grandiose sort of way. And other people can do likewise. Normal is overrated, but you can be successful in whatever way you choose to be successful if you approach it right, and you don't have to suffer. And that's the big message. Even if you come to the table with a genetic loading of ADHD or bipolar or a cluster B personality sort of like borderline or narcissism or whatever, or you have chronic depression, or you have anxiety disorders, or you have a substance abuse and dependency issues, or multiple substance abuse and dependency issues like most of my clients, or you have some combination of all of the above, which a lot of my clients do, there is always hope. There is always light at the end of the tunnel. You can always get better, but you have to engage in the process. And what I tell people is, even if you don't trust yourself, even if you don't believe in yourself, look at the stuff I have on the wall and believe that I have the knowledge and the skills and the procedures that I use are very well vetted. Have faith in those. Engage in the process, and you can be successful. And if normality is your goal, okay, great. If you want to be better than normality or different from normality, whatever, great. But you don't have to suffer.
What would you probably say is a good first step? Like if somebody doesn't know how to do it right, like they really just don't understand how the hell that works because nobody taught them, nobody supported them in it,
sure.
So they're floundering around. Where should somebody start?
That's a great question. What I would say is do some investigating. I mean, do some online investigating. Go to a library if you don't have access to a computer, and I can't imagine anybody these days that doesn't. But if you don't, go to a library and find out, right? Look up some, you know, start if you have the resources, check into some mental health professionals. Call their offices. Ask them what they specialize in. Look at their credentials. Look at how many years they've been practicing. Ask them what their clientele base is like. And even if you can't talk to them, talk to their office manager. The office manager should know what's going on. Ask them, do they work with a lot of these clients? What kind of training and or special skill sets do they have with these clients? So, for example, if they treat anxiety and depression, do they know what cognitive behavioral therapy is? Do they have certifications in cognitive behavioral therapy or at least training in cognitive behavioral therapy? If they work with cluster Bs, particularly borderlines, do they have education and training in dialectic behavior therapy and or are they certified in DBT? You know, that kind of thing. If they work with addictions, don't ask stupid questions like a lot of my people do, and no offense to these folks when I say this, are you a friend of Bill and Bob's? Which basically means, you know, are you a recovering addict? Right.
Well,
and I'm
yeah.
like, hello, that means nada, zero, the empty, it means less than zero, right? That's like saying, hey, that's like somebody calling my office and saying, hey, do you do shoulder surgery? Because I know that you've had shoulder reconstructive surgery as a result of your car accident. So that means you're qualified to do shoulder surgery. Do you do that in your office? I'm serious. That's just that goddamn stupid. Excuse my French, but it's just that goddamn stupid. So instead of asking AA-type questions, why don't you ask, hey, do you have any training or certifications in working with addictions? Oh, do you have any training or certifications, or do you work with adult addicts, or do you work with adolescent addicts too? Okay, do you have a specific type of addiction you work with? Do you work just with alcoholics or do you work with drug addicts? Do you work with gamblers? Do you work with sex addicts? Do you work with porn addicts? Shopping, whatever your addiction is. Do you have experience with those folks? Right? Those are the kind of questions you want. How many years have you been doing it? Oh, I'm real good. I've been doing it for 2 years, and I've had 3 patients. I've been real successful. I joke about it, but I started this business. I started in this business in 83. My first placement was in a residential alcohol and drug treatment center run by the state that was manned and womaned predominantly with adolescents. And that was my first exposure to teenagers and addicts. But I've been doing it ever since. So I'm pretty goddamn experienced, and I'm board certified by every single addiction board on the planet. That is not an exaggeration. So
gotcha. That's
how I got into this business. So do I know addictions? Let me think. You know, I'm one of the only three people in the entire state of Georgia who's board certified in cognitive behavioral therapy, which means I'm also certified with all the rational emotive stuff and the DBT stuff and all this kind of junk. So that's the kind of stuff you need to ask. And I'm not suggesting everybody needs to come to see me. I'm just saying those are the kind of questions you need to ask your clinician. How many years you've been doing it? What are your specialty areas? Do you see teenagers? Do you see little children, which I don't see? Do you do geriatrics, which I don't see? Do you do adults, which I do see, right? So you need to ask those questions, because sometimes people just, they might treat addictions and they might be board certified, but I'm sorry, my license says I can treat children, but I really don't feel qualified to treat children. And that's the case with me, and I don't.
Yeah.
I don't see anybody less than about 12 years old.
Gotcha.
Right.
So,
I just don't...
people can listen to this episode and, you know, kind of write down your suggestions, make a cheat sheet ahead of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And don't be afraid to ask questions. You're not being rude. You really are not. You're educating yourself. Information is power, people. You have to know who you are, putting your potential future in this person's hands. Make damn sure you vet this person. Know who this person is. And what's your intake procedure like? Do you talk for 50 minutes? Are you a medication devotee, or are you an alternative person? Or are you okay with either, depending on the client that you see? Do you have a preference? I mean, what's your therapy style? Those are really important questions to ask, not are you a recovering addict? Are you married? When people call to ask for marital counseling, can't tell you how many times I've had that question. Do you have kids? Oh, that's another one I get from parents. Do you have children? Not that I know of.
Rock and roller. So
I'll tell you a quick cute story behind that, because my answer used to be no, and I was doing a talk to a high school. And one of the high school kids, I love this, really zinged me and did it really well, and I thought it was hilarious. And this high school kid raises his head. He goes, "Well, Dr. Mathis, how do you know you don't have any kids that you're a virgin?" Oh, my God, it was hilarious. And some of the class, it was hilarious. And the class and the teacher were like, "Oh, shit." And I started laughing. I'm like, "Oh, my God, that's great." I said, "Yep, you got me. No, I am not a virgin, and you're right. I don't have. Okay, let me say this a different way. I don't have any kids that I know of. How about that?" And the whole class started laughing, and it took the edge off. But it was true. I mean, the kid was completely right. He got me.
Right? Oh, jeez.
Isn't that great? I love that story. It's true. That happened about 10 or 12 years ago. Yeah, it happened about 10 or 12 years ago, and I just remember that kid had that grin on his face. It was great. Yeah. I'm like, "Oh, my God, dude, you're awesome."
Gotcha.
Yeah, so, but your parents will ask me that, like, "Okay, you don't have any kids. How could you know about parenting?" Okay. And I tell people, "Well, I'm not a chick, but I work with females. I'm not ADHD, but I work predominantly with ADHD people. I'm not an addict, but I work predominantly with addicts." So to quote Mr. Happy, my buddy, as he would say, "So what's your point?"
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But people have this stupid idea. Well, some people, I should take that back. Some people have this dumb idea that if you haven't been there, you can't do it. Or that if you've been there, you get it, so you can do it because you're one of us. No, not really. Because I would never try to do shoulder surgery on anybody. I would never try to do chiropractic on anybody, and I get adjusted pretty frequently.
Yeah.
So Do your homework. Find out about the syndrome. Look it up on the internet. Find out about the syndrome. Look at reputable sites. Don't go to Wikipedia. Go to you know, no offense to Wikipedia, because it's a good starting point if you want to start there. But go to, you know, medically and psychologically vetted sites and read up about it. Talk to friends you might know that have the disorder, or talk to friends you might know that might be in therapy or seeing somebody. Call therapy. You know, look up therapists. Google therapist and see who works with depression or schizophrenia or whatever you think you might have. and find out if you got it or not. Because so many of these disorders look like, walk like, talk like, and smell like each other. You know, you can't self-diagnose. Don't be an armchair shrink.
Right? Yeah.
Too many of these things look like each other.
Yeah.
You know, and I can't tell you how many people come into my office and say, oh, I've got depression really bad and I've had it for a long period of time. And they start talking about it and I'm thinking to myself, you might have depression, but you've also got anxiety. And I'll say that to people and they go, you know, kind of like the David Lee Roth line in Taught for Teacher, I don't feel tardy. I love that video. I don't feel depressed. I don't feel anxious. You know, and I do the MMPI, and they're like, ding, 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 ding. And I'm like, well, look at this. You're 3 standard deviations above the mean. Guess what? That means you have anxiety or you have depression or you have whatever. And they're like, whoa. And I go, what happens is you're so used to feeling stressed out, you don't know how stressed you are. And once they start getting unstressed, they're like, oh, my God, I was really stressed. I'm like, uh-huh. I'll tell you another real quickie and I'll shut up, and I'm sorry to run over. So this happened just last week. So I started one of my ADHD kids, who also has anxiety and depression. One of my ADHD kids started working out again and doing vitamins and herbs and stuff a couple of 3 weeks ago, and they're starting to take effect. And the kid comes in and he says, you know, my anxiety's gotten worse. And I said, really? I said, why do you think that is? He said, because my head of my ADHD stuff is cleared out, and now I realize how stressed out I was, and that's why I was doing all those drugs. And I'm like, uh-huh, good for you. Ding, 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 we have a winner.
Gotcha.
I said, now the trick is, he goes, yeah, they'll go back and use the drugs to medicate that shit away. I went, uh-huh, and he starts laughing. He goes, yeah, that's why I was doing drugs. I went, uh-huh. I'm like, okay, well, there's hope for you, dude. And we were laughing about it. But that often happens. So people, you know, have symptoms. As they get better in one field, their brain clears up and they're like, holy shit, I really am depressed, or holy shit, I really am whatever. And then they get scared and then they want to go to their, you know, the quick and dirty solution. This kid to his credit has not done it. So kudos to him. But I have a lot of people who do. Right. And then, of course, they beat the shit out of themselves. Oh, I fucked up again. I failed again. No, you didn't fail. You just found something that didn't work. Right. Yeah. No.
Okay. Fair enough. So, all right. With that, let's go ahead and wrap this up because we're at the top of the hour. So, in summary, we hope our listeners now better understand the whole nature and nurture debate and choices. And we hope that we've better empowered our listeners to look beyond whatever diagnosis with which we may have been born or whatever personal history and upbringing was forced upon them, and find their own agency and ability to seek whatever help is needed for them to steer their behavior and life as much toward a path that they really want to have, regardless of whatever mental health issues may need addressing along the way. It is possible, and it's a lot more possible for many more of you than you may think. So
definitely
don't fall into the trap of, oh, my mom had X, so I'm always going to be this way. I can't be helped. You know, come out of that trap. There's hope for you. Is there anything else that you want to say on this topic before we wrap?
Yeah, don't, if somebody's told you you can't get better, you can't change, don't believe it. I mean, unless you have a lot of somebody should tell you that, don't believe it. And don't, yeah, take a diagnosis as a death sentence. And, okay, well, I guess I'm just screwed. There's like this one person I told you about earlier who said, well, I got diagnosed with clinical depression, runs in my family, so I'm always going to be depressed. I have to be on these medications. No, you don't. So don't give up on yourself, and don't take your diagnosis as a death sentence or as a end-all and be-all, because you can improve and you can work your way out of a lot of things.
Yeah. Also true. And, you know, even if, you know, you may not get rid of it, like you name several pathologies that don't go away, but you can change your relationship with the whole thing and it will still be there, but you can have a vastly improved life and not let it run you.
And learn workarounds.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So hopefully with that, you guys can get a better handle on this sort of stuff or help somebody in your circle who has got issues like this. So we hope that'll help you guys out. Feel free to replay the episode and take notes about what to ask people if you've never really mastered how to ask good questions. You know, we have some suggestions, so go ahead and play it back and write it down and then take that out and get yourself some good help. All right. I want to give a shout out to some other NDB Media shows that are coming up in the next couple of weeks. But before I do that, on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, I want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who might be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, et cetera. So we'll see you guys. We're going to have a small hiatus. Dr. Mathis has a trip coming up. So we'll see you guys in a month with a new topic for discussion on Wednesday, May 26th at 11 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com. I'm going to check with the head of NDB Media. We may run a rerun of one of our shows on the off week on the 12th, but we will see if that happens. I will let you guys know on the Facebook page if that does happen. All right, other shows coming up. Thursday, Travel Itch Radio on the 29th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. The Bay Area suburb of Concord, California offers a pleasant alternative to the bustling big cities of San Francisco and Oakland. Elaine Schroth of Visits Concord visits Travel Itch Radio with hosts Dan Schlossberg and Mary Ellen Nugent Lee. Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday morning extravaganza, 9 a.m., May 3rd. The Monday morning quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. Oh, wait, that doesn't work. That'd be May 1st then, because Sunday's May 2nd. My bad. 8:30 p.m., Fear Walking Dead Online Viewing Party is back with Season 6, Episode 11, The Holding, on AMC. Please join us on the air by phone or real-time discussions in the chat room, updates, trivia, profiles on the cast and crew, and more. Following Sunday, we're doing on the 9th, will be Season 6, Episode 12, In Dreams. Monday, 10 p.m., Monday Night in America with Roger D. Noriega and his take on politics, current events, entertainment, sci-fi, and history. The Nightmare Hunter with Roger Noriega has moved to Tuesday evenings at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on Streamlabs. And Tuesday the 4th, 10 p.m., is Fandom Access Week in Review. Please look for the Rock and Roll Shrink on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and on the web at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody. Thank you for joining us. See you next time. And rock on. Good night.